Okay. I'm going to talk about financial bubbles today. I guess everyone's confident of knowing about the stock market and housing markets. They have a smaller turnout. But this is something of great entertainment to me, primarily because economists don't seem to be very concerned about financial bubbles, and I think they should be, because I think it's hugely important. And I'll sort of lay out that case tonight. Okay, the main themes I want to hit on, first off, talking about the 90s stock bubble, I want to go through sort of the basic logic of talking about the stock market and stock market predictions, projections. There's this tendency to treat the stock market as being very mysterious, and what I want to say is it's really not, and not that I could tell you what's going to happen in the market tomorrow or next month. That is very mysterious. But what you could say about the market over a long term actually is not that mysterious. So that's what I want to go through. What's the simple arithmetic that allows you to talk about the stock market over a long period of time? Next thing, a housing bubble. I've argued, have been arguing, that we are in a housing bubble now. More economists are now saying that. I think that's a very serious matter, because for most people, their major financial asset is their house. I've debated a lot of people, and they kind of say, well, you know, it's not a big deal. You could always live in your house. And, you know, to my mind, this is kind of, you know, a pretty silly thing to say, because if you have a house that you pay $400,000 for, and next month it's worth $300,000, you just threw $100,000 out. So that's not funny in my view, but that's the argument you get from a lot of people on the other side, or a comment that you get on the other side. That goes with the bubbles aren't cute. I also want to talk about how bubbles harm the economy more generally. Part of the argument I want to make here, you know, last week I was talking about the Fed. The Fed's very concerned about inflation. In fact, some economists think that's the only thing they should worry about. To my view, financial bubbles, financial speculation, could be far more harmful to the economy than, say, modest upticks in the rate of inflation. So the idea that the Fed is going to be looking, going to be very concerned if the inflation rate goes, you know, let's say it's currently about 2.5%, if it goes to 3.5% or 4%, that's a really big deal. But having a stock bubble where you have somewhere in the order of $10 trillion of bubble wealth, or a housing bubble where you have on the order of $5 trillion of housing wealth, have that grow and then disappear, well, I at least think that's a much bigger deal than, you know, going from 2 to 3% inflation or 2 to 3.5% inflation. So I'll make that argument. Then I want to say briefly how the Fed could burst bubbles, because again, it's not, I want to say it's not a mysterious thing, it's not that hard to do. So I want to argue that it's actually a fairly simple process. And the last thing, just make a kind of brief but I think very, very important point about holding experts, economists, financial analysts accountable, because one of the things, it's not just in this area, it's really in all areas of economics, is sort of this idea, well, we tried, we didn't work, and, you know, it didn't work as we thought, and that's okay. And it's not that I want myself or all my colleagues to always get fired, but there does seem to be a point that, you know, when you mess up, you know, other people are held responsible. Economists, financial analysts should also be held responsible. Okay. First point, the arithmetic on a stock bubble, simple arithmetic. You know, the conventional wisdom on stock markets is absolutely right. You know, what is it going to do tomorrow? I have no idea. You know, I can give you a guess and I'll be right half the time. You know, it's huge random elements. You know, it responds to economic events, responds to profit reports. Sometimes, you know, I was looking at today, I followed economic data very closely, and we got a new trade report, and it was much higher deficit. We had a much larger trade deficit for September than was generally expected. Now, I would have expected the markets would have reacted to that by, you know, having interest rates rise and we'd see a fall in stock prices. No, stock prices actually rose today. And at the moment, at least, I have no idea. I mean, I'll go read through the business press tonight, tomorrow, and maybe someone will have an explanation as to why that happened. I don't know. But, you know, on the one hand, you had two surprises there. We had a bigger trade deficit than people expected. I didn't, you know, bigger than I expected, so that was a surprise. And then the reaction was a huge surprise. So, you know, if I'd been predicting what the stock market would have done today, I'd been wrong on two accounts. You know, so, you know, I'll grant, you know, over a day, over a month, over a year, it's unpredictable. Okay, but longer term, I would say it is reasonably predictable. Okay, and what I'll say is that longer term, we can make predictions based on the one hand, profit growth projections, and secondly, price-earnings ratios. Okay, and I'll come back and I'll work through the arithmetic, and it's just very, very simple arithmetic. So it's not, this is nothing terribly complex that requires, you know, advanced training in economics. It's incredibly simple arithmetic that we all had in third grade. Okay, in terms of where we get these from, you know, profit growth projections, none of us know what profits will be in 5 years or 10 years, but we project them all the time. Okay, so if you look at the budget projections that the Congressional Budget Office has, that the Office of Management and Budget, they have profit growth projections for the next decade. Okay, private forecasters have profit growth projections for the next decade. Again, there's no guarantee that they're right, but we're all working from these profit growth projections. I mean, we talk about the budget deficit, and you have people yelling, what does the deficit look like in 2014? Well, that's based on an economic model that has the economy out here in 2014 and has profits over there. Okay, that number could be wrong, but we act as though it's right in all sorts of other contexts. So what I want to say is, okay, fine, let's just use the same numbers everywhere. Let's start from the assumption that the numbers we're using for the budget are not nuts, you know, that makes sense, and then we have a profit growth projection. They're in the same numbers. So any of you who've ever looked at, you know, the 10-year budget projections, look further, you'll find the profit numbers. They're right there. They project taxes on profits, so they have to know what profits will be. They have to at least write a number down. Okay, the next point, stock components. It's the stock returns. You know, stock returns don't fall from air. Well, you could say it falls from air, but you get them in two forms, basically. Either the stock price rises. Okay, you know, if you own a share of, well, General Motors probably won't be going up, but Google seems to be going up. So you own Google today, and it's $300, and next year it's $350. Okay, so that's how you got your return. It went from $300 to $350. The other place you get a return is from a dividend payout. So Google, I don't know if they pay a dividend, but let's say they pay a dividend. Let's say they pay out a dividend of $3 a year. So if the share price is $300, they're paying you 1% dividend. Okay, it's straight arithmetic, nothing terribly complex. Now, making it slightly more complex, but we could ignore this, the other way that companies, in effect, pay out a dividend is they could also have share buybacks. Okay, so maybe Google doesn't send you a $3 check. Maybe what they do is they take 1% of the, you know, an amount of money equal to 1% of the share price, and they buy up their shares. In principle, it amounts to the same thing. There's some tax issues, not looking into details. But basically, that's another way of giving back money to the shareholders. It can be treated exactly the same as a dividend. Okay, so I've had people start yelling at me, oh, what about share? But it's very simple. I've been through this with many economists. You can treat a share buyback as exactly the same as dividends. Okay, so for simplicity, we're just going to say that the stock return is equal to capital gains, how much does the stock price go up, and the dividend payout, which includes the share buybacks. Okay, so we've included that in there, just made it real simple, and that's just definitional. There's nothing else in there. It's a very simple thing. So we just add two numbers together, and we know what our stock returns are. Okay, now we'll work through a scenario, and I'm just going to start with a simplifying assumption, which, you know, I think is sort of a fairly safe assumption. Let's assume that the price-to-earnings ratio is constant through time. Okay, so what does that mean? Currently, I was giving the example of Google. We'll say that Google's price is $300, $300 a share. Let's give them a price-to-earnings ratio of 30 to 1. That means that their earnings per share are $10. Okay, so saying that the price-to-earnings ratio is constant, well, if the price-to-earnings ratio is 30 to 1, if the share price, if the earnings go up by, let's say, 10%, the share price also goes up by 10%. Okay, so what that means is that the price of the stock will rise at the same price, the same rate that earnings grow. Okay, I'll come back to this, but it's sort of a fairly simple story. And I'll alter that assumption, but I just think that that's sort of the simplest assumption to work from. You know, that the price-to-earnings ratio is constant, and, you know, again, I think most economists would agree that in general we don't think of the price-to-earnings ratio going off to infinity or going down to zero, but I'll come back to that. Okay, next, dividend payouts average 60% of profits. That's not an exact number. You'll see that it varies a little bit through time. Sometimes it's a little higher, sometimes it's a little lower. It's a little higher than that now. It's probably about, you know, 66, 67%. It's a little higher than that, but it typically averages about 60% of profits. Okay. The other point on that the reason why that's limited is that companies have to reinvest. If suppose that you had a company that was paying out 100% of its dividend of its earnings as dividends, you have no money to reinvest. Okay, which you could do for a year, 2 years, or 3 years, but that's not typically what you envision as a company that's going to be around for a long period of time and growing. And certainly, if we talk about the market as a whole. Well, there might be some companies that maybe are shrinking, maybe they're paying out all their profits as dividends just because, you know, they're in a declining market, there's nothing else they can do with them. You can't imagine for the economy as a whole that that's the case. Okay, so the 60% assumption, that's more or less historically, you know, the average. And again, if you varied that too much, if you said, let's make it 90%, well, then you have no money left to reinvest, or very little. Okay, so it's, again, it's a ballpark number, it's not written in stone, just you know, makes it very simple for analysis. Okay, so if we say that we have 60% of earnings being paid out as dividends, we could say that the stock returns are equal to profit growth in this case, because profit rate of profit growth is the rate of the share price grows. Okay, earnings grow at the same rate as share price, plus 60% of the earnings yield. Okay, so we take the normal scenario. Let's just look back through time and say, what sort of return would this give us on stock? Okay, historically, profits have grown at roughly the rate of 3% a year. Okay, again, not written in stone, but if you look back over the last 50 or 60 years, it's roughly the average rate. You know, there's issues what it will be going forward, but the average rate historically, roughly 3% a year, which means the stock price goes up 3% a year if we have a constant price-to-earnings ratio. Straightforward, very simple. Okay, historically, okay, we look back over most of the period prior to the 90s bubble, the price-to-earnings ratio averaged roughly 14.5 to 1, which means that the earnings yield, okay, so just taking the inverse of that, okay, what's the ratio of the earnings to the share price? It's 7%. It's roughly 7%. So just taking, you know, the inverse of that, our price-to-earnings ratio, just flip it over, earnings-to-price ratio. So that's roughly 7%. Okay, so here's our simple arithmetic here. The dividend yield is 60% for 7%. Okay, 4.2%. So what's my dividend yield in a typical year pre-bubble? It's about 4.2%. Okay, so what's the total stock return? Here's your simple arithmetic, third grade arithmetic. 3% capital gains, 4.2% dividend yield, 7.2% return. Okay, so if you look back historically, you know, what had been the average return on stock over the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s? Roughly 7.2%. Differs from that in any given year. Sometimes it's negative, some years you do better. But historically, that return has been 7.2%. One other point I should have written earlier, but I'll just say this just to make this very clear. I'm always adjusting for inflation. So we're just read inflation on the story. So if inflation was 7%, then the stock price rose 10%. Okay, so we just moved it from the story. I just made it simpler. There's no inflation in this world. It doesn't change anything if there were. I just would have to have different numbers up there, but we'd get to the exact same place. So I'm always saying, what's the return after you adjust for inflation? Okay, so historically, you know, through the post-war period, we could say that the stock returns averaged 7.2% above the rate of inflation. Okay, what happens when we get to the bubble years? Okay, we have 7.2% as the normal return. Price-to-earnings ratio crossed 20 in 1996. Okay, so historically we have a price-to-earnings ratio of 14.5 to 1. That starts to rise in the 80s. It bounces around. You have a big crash in 87. Starts to go back up. Continues to rise in the 90s, and it crosses 20 in 1996. I should point out, all of you probably heard Alan Greenspan's famous line, irrational exuberance. That was when he said it. Price-to-earnings ratio was about 20 at that point. Okay, so he's worried that the stock market was getting out of hand then. Okay, when the price-to-earnings ratio hit 20, that means the earnings yield was 5%, 1 over 20. Okay, just take 1 over 20, earnings to price, 1 over the price-to-earnings ratio, 5%. Okay, then it continued rising. Price-to-earnings ratio hit 30 in 1999. It actually peaked out. We had the peak in March of 2000. It was about 33 at that point. Okay, but when you get to 30, the price-to-earnings ratio 30, you're looking at an earnings yield of about 3%. Okay, earnings are about 3% of the share price. Okay, what does that do from dividends? Okay, just take the 60% number. Again, this is an exact number, but it's a ballpark number. 60% of 3%, well, 1.8%, it's less than 2% in 1999. Okay, so where does that get us in terms of stock returns? Okay, we have a dividend yield of less than 2%. Okay, when the bubble's at its peak, we're looking at a dividend yield, counting the share buyback, less than 2%. Okay, normal profit growth is 3%. Okay, but we have to keep in mind, in 1996, we were actually looking at a situation that was worse than that, or I shouldn't say 96, in the late 90s. We're looking at a situation that was worse than that, at least for the intermediate future, because we had a cyclical peak in profits. Okay, profits tend to go up and down over the course of a business cycle. We had a price-to-earnings ratio in 1999 of 30 to 1 against the cyclical peak of profits. Okay, what's going to happen after that? Will profits fall? And the Congressional Budget Office actually projected that you'd have negative real profit. That's just the 219. It should be 209. Sorry about that typo. That there would actually be negative real profit growth from 1999 to 2009. So if you go back and you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections of profit growth, they're actually projecting that profit in 2009 would be lower a small amount lower, but nonetheless lower in real terms than it was in 1999. Okay, what should that meant in terms of share price growth? Well, if we expected the price-earnings ratio to remain constant at our record bubble levels, you know, 30 to 1, we're going to say, okay, it's just going to stay at 30 to 1. Well, we're going to get zero real growth in stock prices, no capital gains. Well, no capital gains to show for the next decade, and we have our great 2% yield. Okay, so what does that mean? Our total return, zero return in terms of capital gains, because profits aren't growing over the decade, and we have a 2% dividend yield. Okay, so that doesn't look terribly good. Okay, well, that's the basic arithmetic of the stock bubble. Okay, that you're looking at a situation where you had price-to-earnings ratios that were inconsistent with any sort of very good return on stock prices. Okay, in fact, as I say here, you would have been much better off if you got government bonds. If you go back to this period, 99-2000, you could have gotten an inflation-indexed government bond. I was always saying this to people then. They're looking at me like, what are you doing, marketing inflation-indexed government bond? My reason for saying that is this is like the safest thing in the world. I mean, unless the U.S. government collapses, you know, you're covered, you know, because the U.S. government has always been good on its debt, and in this case, it's actually indexed to inflation. So if I go out and get a normal bond today, well, suppose inflation is 10%, I've lost a lot of money because you know it's been eroded by the value's been eroded by inflation. By an inflation-indexed bond, I'm protected even against that. Okay, so you could have got an inflation-indexed bond in this period, let's say 99, they'll give me a 3.5% interest. So why on earth am I going to put my money in the stock market that you know is going to give me you know somewhere in 2-3% you know return? Why and get totally safe inflation-indexed bond? I don't have to worry about anything and get a 3.5% real return. You have to be pretty crazy. Okay, so that's the logic. I would say anyone should have been able to look at the stock market in the late 90s and go, there's a bubble here. Okay, it's just basic arithmetic. Okay, what if the price-earnings ratio isn't constant? Well, you could have the price-earnings ratio rise. I began doing this because I was doing involved in the Social Security debate, and a lot of people were saying, let's put the Social Security money in the stock market. So I said, well, what would happen? You know, what would that mean? And you know that's why I'm projecting out 75 years because Social Security projection rise in 75 years. So, okay, if you want to get, we had a lot of people in the debate who would say, well, historically stocks have given us a 7% return. So I go, well, that's fine. They're going to give us a 7% return. How are they going to do that? We have this price-to-earnings ratio now that's you know 20 to 1, 25 to 1, eventually over 30 to 1. How are we going to do that? Well, the price-to-earnings ratio would have to keep rising. Yeah, we have to make it up. We can't get it on dividend payouts. The money isn't there. So we have to get it by a constantly rising price-to-earnings ratio. And you see, you get very high price-to-earnings ratios. You get over 100 to 1 by the 30s, you get over 200 to 1 by the 50s, and at the very end of the period, we're looking at over 600 to 1 or even 700 to 1. Okay, I had a lot of fun with this because I harangued a lot of people in the debate. Some of you may have heard I called this the No Economist Left Behind test. I said, you know, if you think we can get a 7% return in the stock market, which is what they were saying, you know, so I wasn't putting numbers in their mouth or in their analysis, they were saying that, just said, write down for me, you know, the combination of, you know, capital gains and dividend yields that you're going to get. And no one could, because, you know, no one wants to say they think that's going to happen. It's nuts. You know, nor do they want to say that you're going to have companies paying out, you know, 5% of their earnings as dividends when their earnings are only 3% of their share price. That doesn't make sense either. So there was no way they could, you know, get around this without something that was basically totally nutty. So basically they're saying nonsense. Okay, so just to complete the scenario, so here you have price-earnings ratio isn't constant, goes up. You could have the price-earnings ratio fall, okay, but then if you have the price-earnings ratio fall, then your capital gains are negative. Okay, so I had a lot of people say that. Well, why wouldn't, you know, maybe the price-to-earnings ratio will fall? And we'll go, well, that's fine. You know, and if the price-to-earnings ratio falls, then, you know, you'll eventually at some point you have a lower price-to-earnings ratio. Let's say it goes back down to its normal level, 14.5 to 1. Okay, then at that point you'll have a higher dividend payout. But in the meantime, you've thrown a lot of money in the garbage. Okay, so I'd have this argument. They'd go, well, maybe you're saying that we should wait till after the stock market crashes. I said, yeah. You know, that's right. That's right. You don't put money in the stock market you're betting is going to crash. That would be really foolish, particularly Social Security money. But okay, so yes, you know, it can be negative, and what that means is for a period of time you have a really bad return, and then at some future point, yeah, you'd have a much better return. Okay, and you know, just the final point, you know, if you have these really high price earnings ratios, you're going to have a very low return unless you think that profits are going to go through the roof. And again, you could have argued that. I mean, someone could have come up to me, and a few people did, not many wanted to say that, but you could say, well, no, you're wrong about profit growth. You know, it's not going to just be stagnant. We're not going to have a cyclical downturn, or it's not going to grow 2% a year. It's actually going to grow 5% a year. Now, that's consistent, but no one believed it. Okay, even during the heyday of the new economy, no one, apart from a few people who were basically considered cranks, no one wanted to say they thought you're going to have 5% real profit growth year in, year out over the next decade. It was considered a crazy position. So very, very few people really wanted to argue that. Okay, so short of, you know, having a totally different view about the economy than what was in all the standard projections, I literally mean all of them, you'd be very hard-pressed to find any economist anywhere that was saying anything qualitatively different from what the Congressional Budget Office was saying. You could look at the stock returns in the 90s and go, well, unless for some reason people are now willing to accept stock returns that are lower than what they get on government bonds, we have a bubble. Okay, so it wasn't a terribly mysterious story. Okay, housing bubble. This is my main chart on the housing bubble, and I really think this gives you most of the story. What I have here, the top, the red line here, is real home prices. Okay, and again, this is adjusted for the rate of inflation. Okay, so we're adjusting home prices for the rate of inflation. So we know house prices rise through time. The question is, do they rise more or less than the rate of inflation? The bottom line is real rents. Okay, so rents adjusted for the rate of inflation. Okay, let me just add one other point about this. I don't want to go into great detail about the way these indexes are constructed, but in principle, these indexes are adjusted for quality. So in the case of the house index, we know that a typical house today is, you know, bigger and better than a house that was built 40 years ago. In principle, that's been adjusted for. So when I'm looking at that red line, I'm saying, how much more would the same house sell for? You know, the house that we were looking at back in 55, how much more would that sell for today, adjusted for inflation, than it did back in 55? Okay, same thing is true with rents. In principle, we're asking about what would the same apartment rent for? Okay, so we're holding in principle quality constant. We're asking, how does that change through time? How does real price change through time? Okay, well, the two points I make about that, if you look at house prices, if we're starting the beginning of the period, we have data dating back to 53, the early 50s. From then until roughly the mid-90s, you have almost no change in the real house price. The ups and downs, you see it falls in the 60s, it hits the bottom about 74, 75, goes up into the late 70s, falls again in the early 80s, goes up again, falls. But if you take that whole period from 53 until 95, there's almost no change in the real house price. Okay, and given the accuracy of this index, you can easily say there is no change. It's basically, house prices move at roughly the rate of inflation. Okay, what can we say about rents? Well, pretty much the same story with rents. They fall more in the 70s. They're probably the exact same pattern. They fall more in the 70s. They bottom out in the early 80s, start to rise again. They rise back, so they get back to where they were about 1998-99. Okay, but again, in the case of rents, rents seem to move at roughly the same rate as the overall rate of inflation. Okay, so what can we say based on this? Well, it doesn't look like, based on this data, there's any tendency for housing costs to rise more or less rapidly than other the prices of other goods, at least on average. Okay, so we're taking everything else in here. We have healthcare costs, we have car prices, clothing, gas prices, everything's in there. And it looks that, at least on average, house prices seem to move at roughly the same pace as other prices until the last 8 years. Okay, what we see happens in the last 8 years, beginning, you know, about 96, 97, house prices begin to take off even after adjusting for inflation. Okay, so we see that with the latest data, we're looking at house prices that are about 70% above the overall rate of inflation. They've risen by about 70 percentage points above the overall rate of inflation in this last, you know, last period. They weren't starting from exactly the same, obviously, so it's a little bit less than that. Okay, but we've had this very big run-up in house prices. Okay, now, the last point I always make on this is we haven't had it with rents. Okay, so whatever is driving home sale prices isn't affecting rents. Okay, so again, I'll come back to this, but I think this is a really key point, because if it's the case that there's something fundamental about the housing market, then presumably that would affect rents as well, somewhat of an increase in rents, but nothing like what we see in home ownership prices. And rents have actually leveled off, and they even have been falling a little bit when you adjust for inflation in the last, you know, year or two. Okay, not a big deal. I don't think it's a big deal to fall, but they're clearly not rising. Okay, so whatever it is that's affected home sale prices does not seem to have affected rents. Okay, and that's my basic story why I'd say there's a bubble. Okay, so for a fundamental, one, why did it just kick in 97? And secondly, if there's something about the housing market, wouldn't you think that would also affect rents? Okay, so I go around and debate this all the time, and I'm on a lot of panels. I'm saying the realtors fundamentals, not just realtors, but I seem to be on a lot of panels with accountants who work for the realtors. And they always say, oh no, it's a fundamental. So they go, well, we have population growth.
Yeah.
We have population growth. We have population growth over the whole, well, the whole history of the country. Okay, and as good economists, they know it's not the fact that the population's growing, it's the rate at which it's growing. And it's actually growing less rapidly now. It's sort of funny, I mean, one of the advantages I get from being in different debates is, you know, I'm in the Social Security debate, but what's the keystone in the Social Security debate? Well, we have slower population, you know. So you're over here, and you're talking to people about slow population growth and how that's a huge problem. Then you go over there with the realtors, and they say, well, we have all this population growth. No, it's not both, and there is slow population growth. There is, you know, we're having fewer kids, you know, we're having slower population growth. Immigration offsets that to some extent, but nowhere near. You know, nowhere near fully, and just in terms of, you know, historically where we sit, obviously our period of peak population growth, or at least population growth in terms of housing demand, well, in the late 70s and the 80s, that was when the baby boomers were first forming their own households, or, you know, moving away from their families, forming their own households. So that was, you know, if we wanted to see a housing bubble because of population growth, that's when we should look for it, not when the baby boomers are in their late 40s and 50s, or just about 60 now, when, you know, they're moving down in smaller houses. Moving apartments or whatever, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, rising incomes that go on, well, everyone's getting rich and, you know, they want to have two homes rather than one or a vacation or whatever. Yeah, that's fine, but we're not getting rich. You know, we have the data on that, and, you know, incomes on average are rising. Most people aren't seeing very rapid rises in income. Wages have been going nowhere the last couple of years. Incomes rose much more rapidly in the 50s and 60s. We did get this run up in house sale prices. Okay, so it doesn't work. You know, yes, incomes are rising, but are they rising more rapidly than in the past? That's an easy one. No,
very clearly not.
Environmental restrictions on building. Yeah, there are environmental restrictions on building, but that's not new. Okay, you know, my brother used to live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and if you go out there, one of the great things, or to my mind, great thing, if you go just north of the city, there's the Marin Headlands, you know, which were formerly an Army base. I think it was an Army base, some sort of military base. And in the 60s, they closed the base and they wanted to use it for development. You know, it's this incredibly valuable real estate just over the bridge from San Francisco, right on the ocean. Well, people in the area said, no, we want to preserve this as parkland. You know, that was like 62, 63. So, you know, environmental regulation is not new. Okay, did it get more intense, more severe in the mid-late 90s?
Well,
you know, Newt Gingrich took over Congress. A lot of state houses were taken over by Republicans. Republicans became governor in New York, you know, in a lot of big states. It's not the area most of us would think is the heyday of environmentalism. Okay, so at least on the face of it, it doesn't seem to fit. A limited supply of land, of course. You know, there's a limited supply of land, but there always has been a limited supply of land. So why in the mid-90s did that suddenly become a big issue? Also, again, I like to talk about the other debates. When we just were debating the stock bubble and, you know, all these people going around, well, it's a new era with the internet, new age, new economy, and time and space don't matter anymore. All right, well, space doesn't matter. Why is the limit on land such a big issue now? Okay, and to be a little serious on that, the internet actually should relax. You know, we could work at home. I work at home a lot. You know, most of you probably do a lot of work at home, which would have been very difficult before the internet. You can't get access to all the things that you can, you know, at home. It's much easier to work at home today than it was 15 years ago. So, if anything, we would have expected other things equal, the constraints on land would be less binding. Okay, so that doesn't seem to fit. The last one, low interest rates. I've had a lot of these folks tell me, you know, I was arguing with a guy from the Mortgage Bankers Association, he goes, well, if you look at what people actually pay as their monthly payment, because we've had this sharp decline in interest rates, and we had the lowest interest rates that we had since the early 50s. You know, so we had a sharp fall in interest rates, they would go, then, you know, actually house prices aren't that high if you look at the monthly payment. They go, well, that's fine, except I don't know any economist who expects interest rates to stay low. Okay, every projection I see has interest rates rising. So if your argument is that we have real high house prices because interest rates are 50-year lows, and every economist around is predicting that interest rates will go pretty much back to where they were, then you're agreeing with me. Okay, we have a bubble. Interest rates will go back up and house prices will go back down. Not very pretty scene for the people who are buying houses today, but that's not an argument against the bubble. That's an argument there is a bubble. Okay, the last point, you know, again, just to drive home this point about fundamentals, I go, you know, on top of everything else, you really don't have any case with any of your fundamentals. But the other thing that should make us a little suspicious here is that your fundamentals just happen to kick in at the same time we have a stock bubble. Okay, it's sort of a simple story. How do these two go together? I make the point they went together in Japan. How did it go together? Well, it's a sort of simple story. There's actually some research that seems to support this, that, you know, you get people that make a lot of money in the NASDAQ. Okay, in 95, 96, 97, you know, first round of tech stocks, they're making money. What do? Well, one thing you do is get a bigger home. Well, in the short term, there's only so many homes you can build. Okay, so what actually happens, you go back during that period, well, a lot of people made money in the NASDAQ, the Fed had a nice study on this. Well, prices of housing in Silicon Valley went up. Okay, so, you know, house prices go up because people have money from the stock market, start to drive house prices up. How does that create a bubble? Well, when people start to see house prices go up, they start to think they'll continue to go up. You get a bubble mentality. You get a lot of people saying, well, this house is really expensive, $400,000 for a two-bedroom, that's a lot of money, but it's going to be worth $500,000 in 3 years anyhow. Okay, you also get a mentality of people saying, well, you know, maybe I'd hold off buying, but if I held off buying, it would just go up in price. You know, so if I waited 3 months, I'm just going to have to pay 10% more. You get a bubble mentality. Okay, so you can have, you know, a stock market bubble feeding off into a housing bubble. That is clearly what you had in the case of Japan in the 80s, I think a bigger scale than what we had here, but I would argue that's the exact same thing we had in the 90s and up through the present, that the stock bubble fed into the housing bubble. Obviously, the stock bubble has since collapsed. Housing bubble is still going, but I would say that's the basic story. Okay, a couple other things on this. Housing market, I debate these people, housing markets are local. Yes, they're local. Okay, so how do you have a national bubble? Well, you don't have a national bubble in the sense that you don't have house prices running up everywhere, but you do have common factors. And most importantly, I would say, you know, the first off, the run-up in stock prices. Secondly, the record low interest rates that we've had the last 3 or 4 years. You know, those have contributed to the run-up in house prices in many markets. Okay, so again, I'm on these panels all the time. You know, you can't say there's a bubble everywhere. No. You know, Peoria, Illinois, there's nothing unusual going on with the home prices. You know, there's a number of places we can point to where there's nothing unusual going on in the home prices. But the areas where we can point to something very unusual, those are very big areas. You know, New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., most of the state of California, Seattle, most of Florida. You know, these are very big areas that probably have about half the population, and it's enough to have a huge impact on the national economy. Okay, just the flip side of that, when the bubble collapses, it won't hit every market equally, and again, the analogy I make is if you look at the stock market, you know, just about everything went down. Just about all stocks went down. Ones that went down most are the ones that were most overvalued, most inflated, the NASDAQ. You know, a lot of internet companies that basically were worthless. They went back to being worthless. Okay, so they lost, in some cases, 99, 100% of their value. But, you know, across the board, General Motors lost money. You know, not because there are particular problems with General Motors, which there are, but it lost money because everything in the market was going down. And that, I think, will be a comparable story that, you know, we'll see the areas that have had the sharpest run-up in home prices where there's not any underlying fundamental. Some of the areas in Florida might fit that bill. Those will see the sharpest falls, but an area like Washington, D.C., where there's also been a very sharp run-up, will just likely see a big fall, too. How do we get there? My best guess is higher interest rates will do it. We're starting to see a run-up in mortgage interest rates. This is quite deliberate policy by the Federal Reserve Board. They are trying to raise mortgage interest rates. And mortgage interest rates, I just saw in the paper before I came here, they're about 6.35. If you go back 6 months ago, they're about 5.7. The more normal level, and I think, is around 7, 7.5. So we're getting there. So mortgage interest rates will likely burst it, but even if they didn't, we're building housing at a near record rate. If we continue to do that, basically it's just supply and demand. You keep throwing homes on the market. The analogy here is new stock offerings, initial public offerings in the NASDAQ back in 2000. You keep throwing them out there, and eventually you run out of people willing to buy them up. Okay, so at some point that will burst, but my guess is that basically interest rates are going to do it. Okay, why they aren't cute? Well, I'm saying this, I mean, it's when you hear people at the Fed talk about it, Alan Greenspan and now Benjamin Bernanke,
you sort of say, well, let me show
that. That the, you know, the Fed, it's not their job, you know, the market goes up, the market goes down. That was Robert Rubin's line on it. I think it's more than that, that this is really, really big for the economy, and just acting like, you know, that's not our concern, you know, we'll deal with the consequences. That's what Greenspan said about the stock bubble. That's not acceptable. And, you know, I'll start with the stock bubble, why that's the case. Misdirected investment. One of the things that amazes me is that the economists who, you know, will say this, Alan Greenspan will be my role model here, but I could put up any number of other economists, they get very upset about inflation. You know, last week I was talking about inflation, you know, if the inflation rate goes to 3.5%, we're supposed to get really angry, really upset, oh my God, what's going wrong, you know, the dollar's worthless. Well, the argument there is people make mistakes. The economy is less efficient with 3.5% inflation than it was with 2.5%, so that's a really big problem. We go, okay, well, what about when you have worthless companies, you know, internet companies that could raise $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion on the stock market, which was actually happening in the late 90s. Well, what are they doing with it? They're doing whatever. You know, they're building stuff that no one's ever going to use. They're setting, you know, they're hiring all their friends to, you know, design software that, you know, they don't know what they're going to do with it. That's a really big waste, because that money could have gone to something productive. But instead, it's going to worthless investment. We'll build a lot of fiber optic capacity that goes up over to you. Know, that's one of the visible examples of it. So if we're concerned about an efficient economy, you're not getting that when you have future inflated stock price. Okay, second point, it's not an accident that we had WorldCom, Enron, Global Crossing, and you put 20 others on that list. We had all these accounting scandals in the middle of the stock bubble. Well, you can hide things. Okay, Enron's able to hide things as long as their stock price keeps going up, because they're just paying their stock to people. You know, shut up. Here's, you know, here's another 1,000 shares. Here's options. You can bury a lot of fraud in, you know, in a stock bubble. Okay, and they did. So, you know, I couldn't have told you that WorldCom or Enron or Global Crossing or any others. I didn't know which one. But I wrote that this was going to happen. It wasn't that it was so brilliant. It was obvious, you know, because you can do that when you have stock prices just going through the roof like that. It creates the opportunity. It's predictable, and of course it happened. Okay, consumer wealth effect. Standard view on stock prices is that a dollar stock wealth leads to roughly 3 to 4 cents of additional consumption. That was a really big boost to the economy in the late 90s. Okay, that's one reason why we had that strong growth in the economy. There's this big boom in consumption. That's good from the standpoint of creating jobs. It's very bad from the standpoint of people planning for their retirement. Okay, so you had a lot of people in the late 90s who thought that they had, you know, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 in 401ks. And, you know, then the market collapsed in 2000, 2001, 2002, and they found out, well, no, they have 100,000, they have half as much as they thought. Okay, so the stimulus to the economy, we could say is a good thing, you know, lower the unemployment rate, we could all be happy about that, but a lot of people made retirement plans that, you know, maybe they quit their job because they thought they were set for retirement. It turned out they weren't, and one of the striking things, you know, we follow very closely here, labor force participation. People over 55 have been going back to work in record numbers, which again is fine if that's their choice, but my guess is a lot of people who are, you know, 58, 59, 60 and working today aren't doing it because they thought it was such a great idea. They're doing that because they thought they had 400,000 sitting in their 401k and they now only have 200,000. Okay, that's not very fine business. Okay, underfunded pension funds. Well, every day you hear about Delphi, you know, the parts manufacturer went bankrupt, their pension funds usually underfunded. United, Northwestern, I can put up again another 20 companies like that. Why are they underfunded? Well, one of the main reasons why they're underfunded is because back in 99, 2000, their stock prices, the stock that's held by their pension fund went through the roof. Everyone said, that's fine, we don't have to put any money in these pension funds. Well, when the market collapsed, they're hugely underfunded. Okay, now if you're a healthy company, General Electric also has a, you know, defined benefit pension fund, they can make that up. Delphi can't, United can't, probably General Motors can't. Okay, we're going to have a lot of companies who have already had a lot, we'll have a lot more, where their pension funds go bankrupt. That's going to be a big tab to the government, and in a lot of cases, workers won't get the pensions that are promised. Okay, not terribly funny in my book. Okay, the last thing, when the market collapses, as it did in 2000, 2001, you get a fall off in demand. Well, part of the story with the stock market was it was fueling investment. That's actually very, very rare, by the way. You know, we all like to tell, or a lot of people like to tell the story, stock market's great because, you know, that's how you invest. Actually, it's very, very rarely true. A very small portion of investment is attributed to a startup company selling stock and then they go out and invest. It's very rare. In the late 90s, that was happening. That was the internet companies. Okay, Okay, so we had this huge surge in investment at the end of the decade, or this substantial surge. That was connected to the stock market. More importantly, we had this big wealth effect, all these people spending all this money based on their stock wealth. Okay, and that goes in reverse. 2000, 2001, 2002, the market plummets, investment falls off, consumption falls off, we get a recession. Okay, now the unfortunate moral that a lot of people took from this is that, well, we can easily counteract that recession. Well, how did Greenspan counteract that recession? Housing bubble.
Very nice.
Actually, before I go to that, let me just make one more point about the housing, about the connection of stock bubble and housing bubble. Basically, I would say that it's sort of a very unfortunate moral of the story, because that was actually a very hard recession to come out of. That, you know, if you look at the prior post-war recession, they were all brought on by raising interest rates, which has sort of a simple story. When you raise interest rates, you cut housing demand, you cut demand for cars. The reason why I'm saying that's simple is because how do you get the economy going again? You lower interest rates, housing, you have pent-up demand for housing because no one's bought a house for 2 years, pent-up demand for cars because no one's bought a car for 2 years. You lower interest rates, it's a big boom in car buying and house building, and you're out of the recession. You couldn't do that in the 1999-2000, you know, following that recession, okay, because that wasn't the basis of it. So it would have been a very hard recession to get out of. How do we get out of it? The housing bubble.
Okay.
Why isn't a housing bubble funny? Okay, first off, overbuilding of housing. Again, if we're one of these economists that's always concerned, is our money being best utilized? Well, if there's ridiculously inflated prices of housing, we build more housing than we probably should. In other words, if builders are looking at home prices, you know, out in the suburbs that are, you know, let's say $400,000 today, whereas they'll be, you know, $300,000 if there were no bubble, they're going to build more homes. Okay, well, we'll probably build more homes than we should, or the wrong homes. You know, we realize there's a lot of people that don't have affordable housing, but they're not going to be living in those $400,000 homes out in the suburbs. Okay, so again, it's a case of misdirected investment. Consumer wealth effect, the exact same story. Definitely more important with housing than with stocks for two reasons. One is the wealth effect is larger. The standard estimate of the wealth effect is a dollar of housing wealth leads to 4 to 6 cents of additional consumption compared to 3 to 4 with stocks. So it leads to spurs in more consumption. But the reason why it's the more important reason why this is a big issue is that housing wealth is more evenly held. Okay, many more people own homes than own stocks. And for most people, it's a major financial asset. Okay, my reason for saying this is a really big deal. Well, you have an awful lot of people that, you know, their baby boomers are getting up in their 50s. They're near retirement. They have a home that they think is worth $400,000. Well, if they're counting on that home to provide them with a lot of their retirement income, you know, maybe they think they're going to sell their home, move somewhere else, and they're going to have $300,000 to put in the bank or a money fund or whatever. Well, if that home falls, you know, by $100,000, $150,000, they're suddenly going to have a lot less money than they were banking on. Okay, and they're not saving today because they think that their home is going to be there to support them in retirement. Okay, so that's a very, very serious matter. Financial panic, the corollary to the sort of accounting fraud, I would say, is that you have a lot of banks that are making what, in many cases, they probably think are bad loans. The reason why they do that, we have a big secondary mortgage market. You go to a bank today, if you take out a mortgage, odds are they're selling that the next day, maybe not the next day, but as soon as they can. They're not holding the mortgage. Okay, you have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are these huge intermediaries. What they do is they take together hundreds and hundreds of mortgages and they sell off bonds against them. So there's this huge secondary mortgage market. What guarantees them? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Okay, and they could deal with the normal recession. I've been on panels with these people and they go, oh, we could deal with this and that. They could deal with the normal recession, no doubt about that. Can they deal with a large-scale collapse of the housing market? My bet is no. I mean, we'll find that out. I haven't gone through their books in great detail. It'd be hard to do, and I don't have the time, and maybe not the expertise. But my bet is no, that if we see a large-scale reversal in the housing market, we might well see a collapse there comparable to what you had with the SNLs and the savings and loans back in the 80s. Okay. And last point, when this goes in reverse, when the housing bubble collapses, well, we get another recession. And in this case, you know, we got out of the stock, the recession from the collapse of the stock bubble by creating a housing bubble. I don't know if there's another bubble out there. Maybe there is, but, you know, I don't know of one. So my guess is that if the housing bubble goes, there will not be a deep recession. It might be long and very bad. Okay, how can the Fed burst its bubble? First thing, you know, saying, does the Fed have a responsibility? I've been on a lot of panels with people and they go, well, this isn't the Fed's job. You know, the Fed worries about inflation. It's not their job. And I like to point out, well, 1987, we had the stock crash. What did Alan Greenspan do? This is just after he came in as Fed chair, but after he took the job. Stock market plummets. What does he do? He runs out and he goes, hey, we got to support the stock market. And he did a lot of things that probably didn't exceed his legal authority, calling up banks and saying, will you, you know, support the brokerage houses, the specialty traders? Not worth going into all the details, but he really worked very hard, very aggressively and effectively in supporting the stock market. Okay, so he thought that was his job to keep the stock market from falling. Okay, but he didn't feel it was his job to do anything about it rising. Okay, it's very interesting. We don't have, you know, at least as far as I can tell as an economist, we have no greater interest in seeing, you know, an overvalued stock market than an undervalued stock market. Okay, but he acted to stem the undervaluation if it was that. I should also point out that his actions in 87 probably helped to contribute to the bubble. So you had a lot of people who thought, well, we don't have to worry about the stock market falling because we know what happens when the stock market falls. Alan Greenspan runs there and bails us out. You know, a lot of people thought that was really nutty, but I mean, a lot of people thought that. The other example I mentioned here in terms of the Fed not getting involved in unusual things, there was this incident, some of you may remember, long-term capital hedge fund. This was this big hedge fund that was having great returns. It had two Nobel Prize economists on its staff who were directing their investment, and they had these great returns. Everyone was talking about them in 96, 97. 98, they ran into trouble. They were suddenly bankrupt. And Alan Greenspan, I've not read up on the details, but he said, you know, he intervened in the unwinding of that because he said it jeopardized the health of the banking system. I don't know if that's really true. Maybe he's helping his friends. I have no idea. But the point is, he was willing to get involved in something that was very far removed from just dealing with inflation. Quite far removed. Okay, regulatory tools. The Fed sets margin requirements in the stock market. Some people buy stock on a margin. They borrow money, in effect, to buy stock. The Fed can control that, can restrict that. I don't think that's that big a deal because, you know, there was a lot of margin buying. People were buying a lot of stock on the margin in the late 90s during the bubble, but even at its peak, when you get to 2000, only about 0.6% of stock on the markets was held through margin borrowing. So it's something that the Fed could do. They could raise the requirements, raise the interest rates, but I don't think it has that much effect. With housing, they do review housing lending standards. They certainly can tighten up, and I think they have to some extent recently, actually, on bank lending for housing. So they do have tools that they could use that are not perfect and not ideal to do it for. Interest rates, that's sort of the blunt instrument. You know, how do you burst the housing bubble? Well, the Fed's raising interest rates right now. I think Alan Greenspan actually does want to burst the housing bubble. Clearly, that's a way to do it. It's not my ideal way. But if you raise interest rates, you raise mortgage rates, that will burst the housing bubble. In terms of stock, you know, if you give people alternatives, if I can get a 10% interest rate on government bonds, well, I'll probably do that rather than putting it in the stock market. So at some point, that would burst the stock bubble. Okay, what's my preferred method? Talk. People often laugh at this. I don't know how many times I say this. You go, oh, the Fed's going to talk the market down. Well, you know, just the sort of simple point, they have enormous audiences for, you know, for their pronouncements, and I'll point out that they actually think they can talk the market up. In 1997, if you go and read Robert Rubin's book, he talks about there was a time where, I forget the exact set of events, but the stock market fell, you know, 2 or 3% a day, and he got concerned about it. So he got Larry Summers as assistant, and I think he had Alan Greenspan in on this, and they all said, the economy's basically sound, there's no reason for the market to fall. So he felt, and probably did, have this effect of talking the market up. But I would say, you know, rather than just saying, you know, giving a thumbs up or thumbs down, if Alan Greenspan or, you know, Rubin as Treasury Secretary, if they had actually laid out the argument that I did, and they have all the charts I have, and plus many, many more, if they had said, here's why there's a stock bubble, here's why there's a housing bubble, every financial analyst in the country would have to deal with that argument. Okay, and think about that for a moment. What am I saying? If Alan Greenspan goes, look, these stock prices don't make any sense. Here's our projection for profit growth. Here's the price-to-earnings ratio. Unless people are holding stock thinking they're going to get a lower return than they do from government bonds, which no one thinks that, then stocks are hugely overvalued. Okay, he goes out and says that, and he's got the charts. Everything's, you know, hard data. Okay, every financial analyst in the country has to have an answer to that. Okay, none of them did, of course, but every single one does. Why do they have to have an answer to that? Because they're all representing someone. Okay, and I'm Joe Rich guy. I've got, you know, $50 million with my financial analyst, and then the market goes through the tubes, goes down the chutes, and, you know, I've lost 2/3 of my money or half my money or whatever it might be. I call him up and go, well, what was your answer to Alan Greenspan? Oh, I didn't bother listening to him. Can't do that. I'd sue him or her. Okay, they have a job. You know, there's no way on earth that you could tell me that if Alan Greenspan or Robert Rubin or, you know, a number of other people would put in those shoes, if they've gone out there and they said, here's the argument, here's why there's a stock bubble, that wouldn't have gotten every financial analyst in the country to take that argument very seriously. And as I say, no one had an answer to that. No one had an answer, and I think that would have collapsed the bubble. Same thing with the housing market. It's a little less direct, but again, it's the same sort of story. If, you know, Alan Greenspan chooses to use his bully pulpit to say, you know, look, we have a housing bubble, here's why, this doesn't make sense, I think would very, very quickly deflate the bubble. My last point on that is, what's to lose? You know, if Alan Greenspan agrees with me, he agreed with me in 96, he actually did, you know, by the way, you could read his minutes, he did agree with me. So what is to lose? What is to lose by Alan Greenspan giving people information? If they think Alan Greenspan's wrong and they know better, no one's preventing them from acting based on it. But what is wrong with him sharing that information? What has he harmed by sharing that information? One of the things that I was once debating someone, they go, well, it's not Alan Greenspan's job to give investment advice. Well, Alan Greenspan, when mortgage interest rates were at their lowest point in 50 years, advised people to get variable rate mortgages. So he was willing to give them personal investment advice like that, but he wasn't willing to talk about a stock bubble or a housing bubble. Okay, last slide. Holding the experts accountable. It wasn't a mystery that there was a stock bubble. It's not a mystery that there's a housing bubble. This is the job of people like me, economists, financial analysts. You know, we should be held to account if 10 years from now house prices are twice what they are today, then you should all come back and make fun of me. Hopefully I'm in a different occupation. I should be. You know, I put at this point, custodians, people really think I'm being funny. I'm not being funny. If you go to economists, you know, there's a huge literature. It's really important that when people don't do their job, they should get fired. Okay, that encourages, that means they'll be responsible. And, you know, we've had debates on this because in Europe, it's much, much harder to fire workers for not doing their job. And there's all these economists who think that's an outrage. You know, you go over to the IMF or the OECD or the World Bank, they go, you got to be able to hold people accountable. You know, so what are they talking about? Factory worker that, you know, is late to the job or they mess up or whatever, or the custodian doesn't do a good job cleaning the bathroom, those people have to get fired. So then we go, well, what about you when you give bad advice? And they think that's funny. They go, no, I'm serious. I'm serious. How come you don't think you should be held accountable? And they're not. You know, when is someone fired for not doing their job? As an economist, as a financial analyst, very rarely. In the case of stock bubble, you know, I've often asked, does anyone know anyone who lost their job for failing to miss the stock bubble? No one has yet found anyone. You know, we had some people commit outright fraud. They lost their job. I just mean, you know, someone's doing their work and somehow didn't see it. None of them lost their job. Congressional Budget Office, Social Security Administration. We just had the Social Security debate this year. They were telling us the stock market was going to give 6.5% or 7% real returns. They couldn't support those numbers. I kept throwing the no economist left behind test at them. No one took it. Okay, so they're putting down bogus numbers that they were trying to influence policy about the nation's most important social program. No accountability. One of the reasons we have the budget deficit we do, I shouldn't say one of the reasons we have the budget deficit we do, but one of the reasons our projections were so far off, the Congressional Budget Office overestimated capital gains tax revenue by close to $1 trillion. I'm being a little loose here because I'm throwing in interest. Okay, but they overestimated, if you go back to 2000, their estimates of the capital gains tax revenue, they basically assumed that the stock bubble would just continue for the next decade, even as they're projecting profits would actually fall in real terms. I tried to talk to these people. You couldn't get it. They go, well, you know, stock market, you know, you can't predict. You know, well, no, you could predict. That didn't make sense. You were wrong. We paid a really big price for it, and none of them lost their job. I don't have any personal vendetta against any of these people. As far as I know, they're all good people. I've never had any arguments with them. But come on. You know, that was foreseeable, and it was a big mistake. Okay, so the last point I just say is it's reasonable to say when you miss something like this, you should be held accountable. Maybe we'd be less likely to have these bubbles in the future. Okay, so just sum up. Financial markets are not that mysterious. We shouldn't let people act like, you know, this is, you know, this weird blob out there that, you know, we just sort of look at and we need mystics to analyze it. There's a lot of hard things about it, but the basic story is often very simple. The damage from these bubbles is enormous. You know, this idea, well, they go up, they go down, and we'll just, no, that's not true. The people who lost much of their retirement savings in the stock crash, You know, that's not funny. They can't make that up when they're 60. And the same thing now with the housing bubble. It is the Fed and Treasury's response. And the last point, people got to be held accountable. All right, so I'll stop. We'll break for about 5 minutes.